If you really want to be impactful, you've got to know yourself incredibly deeply. If you stop thinking about vulnerability, care, empathy as negative or as not leadership traits, you will find yourself much more impactful, because the more you bring those elements into your space as you lead your teams, you'll actually realize that you'll be a much stronger leader. Authenticity and vulnerability is a big part of why I'm as impactful as I am. If you describe yourself by your job, you might have a problem, because if you lose the job, then who are you really?
My name is Sarah Kumalo, a businesswoman, a mother, and an award-winning mountaineer. I know what it feels like when the ground shakes beneath you. 3 times, Mount Everest sent me back down through avalanche, earthquake, and injury. 3 times, the world told me to quit. I kept going, and on the 4th attempt, I stood on the summit. Most would call the earlier attempts failure, but I learned something different. The shift is not the disruption. The shift is the lesson. It's not the fall that defines you, but the rise. Because true failure only happens when you stop taking the next step. In when shift happens, we explore the moments that break us and how they build us. Take a breath. The air is thin up here, and the views are worth it. Welcome to the Summit Journey. Let's go higher.
Welcome to When Shift Happens. The real shift isn't really about getting to the top. It's about what we build when we get to the top. And my guest today is none other than Kensani Nobanda, a brand, marketing, and corporate executive expert with over 20 years' experience working on global brands. As a Lori's Marketing Leadership and Innovations Awards winner, among many other accolades, she's proven that true leadership is not just about results, but also about responsibility. Kensani, welcome, really, and thank you for making it through traffic this morning.
No, I mean, like, for you, Sarah. Absolute pleasure.
Let's start with the fact that you've inspired in spaces where women traditionally are not given room to create impact boldly, right? And yet you do so with grace. If one had to ask you, in your own words, who is Kensani Nobanda, what would you say?
Wow, that's a beautiful question, actually, and quite reflective. Maybe to answer the question, Sarah, I need to take a little bit of a step back and go back to 2010. Because I think in many ways I was brought up to know who I am and to stand up for who I am. I had a dad who made it incredibly clear to me that no one can tell you who you can or cannot be, what you can or cannot be, and what you can or cannot say. And to be told that from a very young age, I think is pretty special. You grow up pretty clear about who you are. But in 2010, I was working in Dubai at that time. I was looking after skin for Africa, Middle East, and Turkey. And I had a boss who, as I reflect back right now, I can give him grace because he had his own, I would say, aspirations and ambitions. And in trying to achieve those aspirations and ambitions, left a couple of dead bodies behind him. And so no matter what I tried to do, it was just never good enough for him. And so in 2010, I was back in South Africa for just the World Cup. It was opening match and all of that. And I was speaking to my 19-year-old brother. And I was telling him how miserable I was at work. And he said to me, well, just resign. He was like, when are you 19? How do you know about just resign?
Like, who cares?
Like, yeah. And my brother's like, why is it so dramatic? Just leave, you know, and stuff. And then a month later, unfortunately, my brother was killed and it hit me incredibly hard. And so I remember reflecting on his just resign, like, why are you taking this, you know? And then thinking about, you can be in such a space that doesn't give you any energy, actually drains you and stuff. And then you die. Like, that just made no sense to me. And so I decided to take a break from working so I did just resign and I didn't have a job. I had nothing. But in that time, I sat back to articulate for myself what it meant to be Kensani in the world. And whilst I'd always, like I said, I'd always been brought up to just authentically be me, I'd never quite probably articulated it exactly.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing is Kenzie is someone who, whether you experience her at a corporate environment, personally with her family on a mountain, yeah, she is as authentic as you will ever find her. Like, you'll never see me in a different... No one can say, oh, I thought she was shy. You know, so I think, I mean, very sort of authentic. I think the second bit for me is very purpose-led. And that bit comes through whether it's my career or just my personal sort of life. And the purpose bit for me, so part of taking that 6-month break was saying I wanted to work in organizations that I could see had a real purpose around changing our continent, our country, like making a real impact and stuff. And so even when I reflect on the work that we do sometimes at Nedbank, I feel incredibly privileged to be able to lead some of that or be part of it. But also for my own self, I didn't have a purpose actually until that moment. And I was able to, and I mean, we can chat about it later around how I got to that purpose. But my purpose is to show the art of the possible, because I always say for a young Black woman like me to be where she is not by like accident, but yeah, it's inspiring for a lot of people. And a lot of people don't want to take the mantle of being mentors or inspire people. And I don't mind it because I understand that when I was growing up, I had few Black women that I could look up to and go, you know, I can make it if she made it and stuff. So I understand the responsibility that I have. And so very purpose-led and like love to take that in. And I have no issues with it. I guess in many ways, so I'm the eldest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I know, because I'm so cool. Everyone thinks she must be the youngest.
Like, yeah, I wouldn't have guessed.
Yeah, like honestly, I am the eldest. But also on my mom's side, when we're very close in my mom's family, in terms of the grandkids, I'm the second eldest. But generally, Gary knows I'm the eldest. So play a very big family role. So I'm married with our dog Samuel L. Jackson, and we don't have kids. I've got lots of nephews and nieces. I'm very tight with my cousins and my aunts and stuff. So really strong family bond. We still have family in Eswatini, and you know, we see them like very often and stuff. But also just like a person who just loves life. I mean, I'm turning 50 in 3 years and I'm on my 50 before 50 list. I'm on number 20. Oh, and so amazing. For me, it's about, I don't want to just exist. So Kenzie is someone who really, when my body gets put into that coffin, it must be like, I'm done. I'm out. Peace. I want to live life.
Yeah. As you say that, I'm thinking about you on the mountain, whether it's Mafari or on Kilimanjaro going gang, gang, wood. With the porters and stuff. And one thing that didn't come out in your narration right now is that you are very naughty. Because I'm like, what is she doing? I'm like, yeah, but you love life. And that's how we should live. I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
I love that about you. Apart from all that, what shift has happened in your life until now that's made you realize or become the leader that you are? So this is beyond who you are, but how you lead other people, whether it's at work, in your family or community or just generally.
Yeah. So I definitely think my brother's death was a massive shift. And whilst it led to me taking a sabbatical, it also led to a number of things. So, I mean, let me start with the purpose bit. So if you think about my background, so my dad is from Orlando and comes from the apartheid, born during apartheid. And in everything, he was never meant to be, to amount to anything, right? And he left South Africa at the age of 17 years old. My mom was born in a place called Fontaine, Efandeni, in Swaziland. She's half Portuguese, half Swati. Also, you know, born to a Portuguese man who would go to Swaziland. So he would do business in Maputo and Mbabane. And he met my grandmother, who was a cleaner in the hotel that he would stay at every time, you know, he would go, you know, do business there. And I don't know, fell in love with my grandmother. And 7 kids later, you know, my mom is number 3 there. But even though my grandfather was a businessman, ultimately, if you look at when I was born, I was actually like the first 6 months of my life living in a mud house with my grandmother, because my mom then was finishing her degree. So she gave birth to me. My dad was out of the country because he joined the MK with the ANC. So, you know, got shipped to my grandmother. So if you think about that as a background, a dad coming from where he's never meant to amount to anything, a mom coming from quite a rural area, I really am not meant to sit on an exco of a bank. but I am. And I think that's a big part of my purpose, because I could accept that, Sarah, and be like, this is great for me. But I realize that actually it can inspire millions of others. In fact, even if it's one, but for me, it's like, how do I do that beyond that? So how that purpose has come alive is, one, after my brother's death, launched the Alex Foundation. So when he passed on, he was studying animation at Open Window. And so, you know, I always think about the conversation. So I'm the eldest, right? And I do marketing. My sister after me, filmmaker, she studied it after.
Okay.
Alex was doing animation. Lulu is an advertiser. Like, we're all creative, coming from a dad who was a soldier and a mom who's a teacher. I don't know how that works out. But I also know the conversations at home around when Alex wanted to study animation. My dad is like, I'm a Popeye. Like, what are you going to be doing? And how, because I'm the eldest, I was able to say to my parents, there is a career in this thing and stuff. And they agreed to pay for him. But I know how in so many families that, you know, especially like, you know, disadvantaged families, that conversation is really difficult if you say you want to study in the creative field. So with the Alex Foundation, we fund kids from disadvantaged backgrounds who study in the creative fields. And one of the most, you know, sublime moments for me was last year at the Lurie's, when the Young Creative of the Year, the young colored girl from Cape Town, Joey Gordon, won Young Creative of the Year. And she actually was sponsored by the Alex Foundation. And you look at it and you realize this is impact, right? So I think the Alex Foundation for me is massive. I think the second part of it is I launched a mentorship platform called Own Your Path. There was a little bit of selfishness in it. I was doing a lot of mentorship and I was finding that it was draining me quite a lot, because you take on people's stories, but also there's so many people who ask you and you just think, I just don't physically have the time. So at its basic level, Own Your Path is like a Tinder for mentors and mentees. So you have that
Tinder.
So you have mentees on the platform, you've got mentors on the platform, and they can match and stuff. And then they own the relationship from there. And I found that I've been able to make a bigger impact using Own Your Path. And I think the shift for me was realizing that whilst I can sit in my house and drink wine and be like, I've done really well, this is great, actually, this is beyond me. And if we want these type of stories to not be, you know, and like an anomaly, or to not be, oh, wow, she's that, you know, just to be the norm and still celebrated, but just like it's the norm, we need to see more role models, especially Black female role models who are in different spaces. So, you know, if I think about you, like, it's important that young Black girls think, I can do the Seven Summits because I saw someone like Sarah, right? Like, so it's important that they can see a Kenzie and be like, I can be on an Exco of a bank. Or see, so just like a variety of role models that allow them to dream even beyond, you know, where they are. So I think the biggest shift for me was realizing that my success, it can't just be owned by me. It needed to be broader and shared much more broadly.
I love that, above the clouds. And it is one thing that I hold dear, because my mother used to say, the sky is the limit. And for me, I interpreted it as what I can see up there, that's what I must reach for.
Ah, it's beautiful.
But when I got to the mountain, I realized that the clouds are beneath me. So I have unlimited potential. And I think if we can let the African child, whether they are Black or white, understand that, internalize it, then the sky is not the limit.
Absolutely.
You know, we can really stand above the clouds.
Yeah.
So we all face moments when the ground shifts beneath us. You know, I did on Everest and many other spaces in my life. When certainty disappears, can you take us to a moment like that in your life and what it taught you about who you are becoming?
Yeah. And again, you know, you've got a lot of setbacks, they happen. And I always say the biggest one was obviously my brother's death. But unfortunately, again, and it's sad that it has to take death for you to take a step back. But when my sister committed suicide about 3 years ago and stuff,
Sorry about that.
Yeah. But I can tell you, Sarah, so, I mean, I've learned so much now about mental health and mental wellness simply because of my sister and the journey we went through with her, because it's not like we just got to the point where she committed suicide. Actually, we knew she was going through depression, you know, and everything she was going through. And we took her to different clinics to help her. And in the end, it didn't work out. And I think as a family, we are quite certain that where she is a much better place for her than what she was experiencing living on Earth with us, because it was incredibly painful for her. That much is clear to us. But what was also important for us was we were never going to lie about, maybe not lie, because let me not say people lie, but they don't talk about it. Like, we were going to talk about mental illness very openly, and we did that at her funeral. And we were going to talk about suicide very openly, because I think if we want, you know, the success bit is great, but we need to also develop individuals or help individuals become very aware of where they are mentally and be able to deal with it. It's not that you're always going to be okay. That was a big lesson for me, because I actually realized also at that time that I wasn't okay. And so, and yes, I wasn't okay because my sister died, but actually I had bigger issues. And I'll tell you exactly what happened. So there's a guy called Mike Stopforth, and I'd heard of him. He's in advertising, but I didn't really know him. And he'd posted something on X about a book he'd read. And it just said, he said, and this guy has sold like multiple businesses for millions of rands. I mean, you, when you look at this guy, you think this guy is incredibly successful. And then he posted something like, this book has helped me get through my depression. And I was like, Mike Stopforth is depressed. Oh, I was so like, and then I decided, let me read the book. And the book spoke about mental connections, or and how actually, if you think about what drives, and it's the spectrum all the way from anxiety to your depression, you know, and all of that. And it talks about it gets driven by the fact that we've got 7 connections that we lose along the way. One of the connections is connections to nature, connections to each other, people, connections to like a title, connection. And then sometimes there's childhood trauma. And those things made me reflect on myself. One, I guess, to understand what my sister was going through. But more importantly, I think for me to understand what I was losing connection to and why I was feeling the way I was feeling. And so, you know, things like bringing in meditation into my life, really starting, because I've always been a runner. But when I started to say, I actually wanted to connect more with nature, I mean, things like working from home and you sit in the office when you can sit in the garden and actually just be much more, you know, at peace, and taking a walk with our dog, and ensuring that whilst I love my family, I need to ensure that I'm more connected to them. Ensuring also on title. I mean, what Mike said was, when he sold his businesses, whilst he made a lot of money, the title of being a CEO was gone. And he sort of didn't realize, like, but where is he? Who is he now in the world? And so if you describe yourself in your job or by your job, you might have a problem. Because if you lose the job, then who are you really? Yeah. And so understanding that for me is just, it's a great job. I enjoy it, but it just pays my bills, right? And stuff. It's actually not who Kinsey is at her essence. And that was a massive shift for me. And also what I've learned is to forgive myself, because in many ways you can say, okay, I've read the book, and I have to read it sometimes like every 6 months to remind myself, because you get into the grudge of things, like, and you do everything and you forget that, didn't I promise myself that I would be meditating? Didn't I promise myself I'd connect to nature? Didn't I promise myself? But don't actually be hard on yourself. Hey, just be like, oh, I've just lost it a little bit, but, you know, let me come back and stuff. And yeah, so it's unfortunate that I got to learn about the book given the grief I was going through. But again, and maybe in both ways, if I think about my brother and my sister, they've actually fundamentally changed my life for better with their deaths. And I'm the eldest, and I've lost, you know, my 2 youngest siblings, which is heartbreaking and heart-wrenching for me when I think about it. But I also think about the role that they've played in ensuring that actually I at least try to become a better version of myself. So, you know, death's not like, no, you don't wish that on anyone. But I think the shift that happens when you think about like what it can shift for you in thinking about their deaths very differently, I think can be powerful. And maybe the last thing, and again, I'm sorry that it goes back to death, but when I was at Harvard studying my advanced management program, and I remember we had a week to go on the program, and I found out that I was one of the top 3 of the 177 students from like 44 countries around the world who'd been nominated to be the class speaker for graduation. And I was like, me? Oh, I mean, Papa, so how does that be like?
Maggie, that's why, right?
And then the day I found out my dad had passed on, I was in Boston, and I remember, you know, and I went to tell the admin office that, you know, this is what happened. And I mean, the first thing, by the way, NetBank was like, whatever you want to do, If you want to stay and finish, you've got 10 more days. That's okay. And, you know, we'll figure that out. If you want to come back to bury your dad and go back, that's also fine. If you want to stop and finish next year, also fine. Like, Nedbank was like, they were insanely supportive. They were like, whatever you want to do. And my husband was coming to join me for graduation. They said, it will sort both you and your hubby out. Like, we'll figure it out. And then I remember calling my mom and saying, you know, my mom was like, if you don't finish at Harvard, your dad is going to haunt us. He's been telling everyone that his daughter is at Harvard. Like, so again, to have a family that just says, oh, no, we finish Harvard, we'll bury your dad when you get back, but you're finishing because he's going to haunt us for life, was just relieves you of just the stress and drama. But anyway, so I go to the admin office and I say, you know, this is what's happened. So the lady looks at me and she goes, oh, what if you've been voted by the class as the class speaker? Like, would you still do it? So I'm like thinking, and I was fortunate enough that my cousin, who our dads are brothers, was in Boston as well, studying somewhere else. And she was with me. And my cousin just said, yes, she'll still do it. Like, it's tough. Okay. And then the lady was like, actually, you have been voted like class speaker. And it was a seminal moment because I remember standing at graduation, and it was 44 countries, either online or in the room. And I got to actually, yes, give the, you know, sort of summarize what we'd gone through as a class, but also honor my dad in such a public forum.
Wow.
And, you know, just talk about how he instilled in me that no one can tell you what you can or cannot be. And also, by the way, my dad used to have this thing when he'd meet my friends and he'd say, why are you here? And like, if you're at a wedding or whatever, you're like, no, I'm at the wedding. And they're like, no, he says, on earth. But then people are like, yo, your dad is stressful.
It's deep,
you know. So to be able to talk about him in such a public platform in that way and just honor him, it for me was actually really special. I miss him. I miss my sister and my brother. But let me tell you, Sarah, I think the biggest shift for me has been to recognize that in grief, and I still grieve them deeply, but in grief, there can be a lot of growth. And I've used that as something that really just anchors me.
I love that. I was getting emotional because it's very close to me because I had a big shift when I lost my older sister as well. Mm. Just reflecting on, oh, why her? Mm. I'm also next. So how intentional should I be? Mm. It completely changed my life. So thank you for sharing. And also, thank you for sharing. I know you brought your sister's ashes to Kilimanjaro. That was a special moment. I know it was private, but somehow I feel like I was a little bit a part of that.
Yeah.
And that's a special place to leave her. And I'm sure she's looking after you in her own way.
I always say, if you want to understand Kensi, that summit is typical Kensi. Have a very private spiritual moment, actually. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm spreading my sister's ashes, reading a letter from my other sister, and then going from there back to you guys and opening a half bottle of champagne.
A champagne shower.
That can see exactly.
I actually didn't know you had the ashes until we were up there, which was like, okay, does she want us to be part of this? Does she not? But when you shared, it's like, okay, you know, we are part of this.
No, absolutely. And I mean, my family came to the airport before I left for Tanzania, and my sister gave me the ashes. My mom spoke to us, and it was just beautiful. And I think the thing for us is we always acknowledge our family, even the ones we've lost. You know, it's they're part of us. And so, yeah.
Amazing. So as a leader who connects brands, businesses and purpose, you know how quickly people can drift out of alignment under pressure, right? What are three simple yet impactful leadership habits that can help individuals or teams remain grounded, authentic and focused, regardless of the uncertainties that's happening in the environment?
So I think the first thing, and it sounds easy, but it's not, is to have a high level of self-awareness. And you've got to, and getting to a high level of self-awareness sometimes means being able to take feedback from people to actually get you to have an understanding of who you are. And I'll give you an example of how you can drift away if you don't have that. So when I was 25, I got made a category director at Unilever, and it was like, oh, I'm a director, geez, I don't know what these people are thinking. But I was Case Kreitoff, who was the MD of Unilever South Africa, ensured that I had a coach and a mentor and like all of those things to make sure that I was successful. But I got feedback from someone who said to me, you know, your energy is such that if you're in a room and you're in a good mood, the room is in a good mood. If you're in a room and you're in a bad mood, the room is in a bad mood. So you've got to learn how to manage your energy. And initially I was like, I'm not listening to this person. Yeah, I'm like, you know, but I started looking at it and watching it. And I realized that actually my energy is impactful and it can be impactful in a very negative way. And if I want to be a leader of people, I've got to ensure that I try calibrated, like, you know, at least from the negative side, you know. So when I was talking about the book Mental Connections and stuff, one of the reasons was in that self-awareness mode, I realized I was leaking. So I'd taught myself for so long how to try regulate my emotions, but I got to a point where actually I wasn't. I was snappy. I would literally walk into a room. This is like 3 years ago, guys. Like I'd literally walk into a room and my team is just sitting there thinking, is she in a good mood? Is she in a bad mood? Like, what? Oh, and I mean, how like sucky is that for your team to be able, like, to want to, when I think about it, but it's okay. It's part of my learning and growing and stuff. Yeah. And so having that high level of self-awareness is important because there's things that maybe you need to work on, but then they leak, right? Because life happens. And so I think that's the first thing is if you really want to be impactful, you've got to know yourself incredibly deeply. I think the second thing is, and it's a balance. So one of the things I learned in Kilimanjaro, and you know, people ask me like a lot of it, is that when you're a leader, you're so used to being in front and making the decisions, making the call. And on Kili, I wasn't the expert and I needed other people to tell me what to do. And for me, that's very difficult because I'm always telling people what to do.
But you took it well. I didn't see it.
And it actually, I enjoyed it. I was like, I don't have to decide. Someone else is deciding. This is amazing. And so, and in that, by the way, when you decide that there's moments when I can tell you, just give someone else like the opportunity to lead. It takes up so much pressure from you. You realize that in that empowerment, you become a better leader. You grow better bench strength, even for your role or other roles and stuff. It's actually selfishly, you should just allow other people to lead because it's actually better for you. And the trust that comes from that, I always speak about that jump on Barranco Wall.
Yeah.
To trust that the other person on the other side is going to hold you is a massive thing. Because you're like, they don't hold me on the other side. Yeah, you're looking down the mountain and you're like, this is precipitous, you know. But it was such a big lesson for me around just like knowing that there are a lot of moments when just allow other people to lead and take a step back. I think as leaders, we try too hard, I think, to be honest. Not, in fact, we try too hard. And we must be the rah, rah, let's do this. Just allow other people to do it. And actually, the growth of those people is going to be incredible. And you yourself, you know, when you can work yourself out of your job, you're in the best place since time. So that was like, I think, a massive lesson for me around just impact and ensuring that you have a cohort of people who are going to be the next Sarah's, Kenzie's, you know, exactly. And which is incredible. Then I think the last part for me is honestly authenticity. Like I said, like when you ask me who I am, it is my core value. What I learned was that if you want to get the best out of me, you've got to allow me to be myself. Yeah. And sometimes what I do to push the boundaries. So when I had my first interview at Nedbank, I got there wearing all-star sneakers. I had a t-shirt because I needed them to see my tattoos and stuff. And it was important for me because I don't want them to hire me. And then now when I come in with my sneakers and they see my tattoos and they're like, Kenti, what was going on? What happened? This is not the person we saw in the interview. So it's about underlining for them who they are getting. But also when I say like the first board meeting at Nedbank, again, walked in with sneaks, and then I'll throw an F word in there, and then look at them in the room. Like, what are they gonna say?
Like, are they shoved enough?
Yeah, I mean, you know. But it lays the groundwork for who Kenzie is going to be, and the organization can decide that time. This chick's not gonna work for us and stuff. And the absolute sort of perfection thing for me that happened was Nedbank was like, I mean, look, just different, but we love her, and you know.
Let's try this. It's different.
Let's, you know what I mean? And so the reason I've been able to do so well at Nedbank, honestly, is because the organization has allowed me to just be 150% me and stuff. I know when to tone it down. That's why I say sometimes I push the boundaries just to, like, you know, test them and stuff. So I would say, as a leader, when people experience you authentically, I can tell you, well, you know, you yourself are going to do your best work, but people are going to do their best work for you, because they know, like, what they see is what they like. They know exactly what they're dealing with. And actually, in that authenticity is about vulnerability, right? I can remember after I read Mental Connections and decided to go on a personal retreat to Mexico to do all the, and you know, that's the other thing about guys, we never fully formed, fully perfect, fully. I think life is just constantly growing and trying to get, like, just the best version of yourself, and it'll never be the best because just that's how life is. But when I stood in front of my team and we were celebrating our recognitions, our top achievers and all of that, and when I did my speech, I said, like, it's great, guys, well done, everyone. But and that's the moment I told my team that I wasn't okay. And I said, and I hope that as you try to achieve and all of that, that if you always recognize where you are emotionally and mentally, because it's no use winning all these awards. And when you sit alone, you're actually not in a good place and stuff. And the number of people, Sarah, who came to me afterwards to say, to see our boss just tell us, I'm not okay, guys, like, I'm taking some time out to go on a personal retreat and all of that, gives them the permission to be themselves, to be vulnerable when they need to be. And I find actually now that some of the engagements I have are much deeper and more impactful than if I just pretended that I go through life at 150 miles, and most people probably think I do. But actually, when I share pretty openly, so I think that authenticity and vulnerability is a big part of why I'm as impactful as I am.
Amazing. I want to actually thank you for allowing me and my team to lead on Kili. Mm. I must tell you, I was under a lot of pressure because you were making it very clear that I'm not making any decisions. Sarah, are you sure? You looked at me right in the face like, are you sure this is what we should be doing? I'm like, Kenzie, I'm sure. Then I get out of that tent, I'm like, flipping hell, I better make sure. But it was just amazing to feel trusted, because sometimes you get people that lead in corporate and they come on the mountain and they want to be bosses on the mountain. And you look at them and say, listen, this guy that has only grade 7 is actually the leader here. And just trust him. Mm-hmm. You know, ask questions for clarity, but trust, because your summit is their summit. They may not be in the picture. They are the unsung heroes that make it possible. That's why I'm very passionate about porters and shepherds, because we don't give them enough credit. But anyway, Kensani, when everything around you is shifting in one way or another, vulnerability often, which you've also mentioned, feels like a risk for most people. And it sounds like it's not for you. What would you say to women leaders who are caring so much but still hesitate to see vulnerability as part of their superpower?
Yeah. I mean, the word superpower is so appropriate. For me, one of the biggest lessons I learned, and I guess I knew it, but COVID highlighted it. So if you think about the leaders who did really well globally, it was the New Zealand Prime Minister, women leaders.
Absolutely.
And I think it came from a place of empathy and care, which are traits that women innately generally have. Men also do, but for women, like, it's, you know, innately women have those. And in the past, they've been looked at as not leadership traits. So you're too soft, you're too nice, you know, and all of that. And actually, what COVID showed very obviously was that those traits are actually superpowers.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you can't make the hard decision, but you can make the hard decision with empathy, understanding the impact on the other side. And that impact is not just a numbers impact. It's a people impact as well. It's a societal impact. And you've got to take all of that into account. So for me, what I would say as a woman is, if you stop thinking about vulnerability, care, empathy, as negative or as not leadership traits, you will find yourself much more impactful, because the more you bring those elements into your space as you lead your teams, you'll actually realize that you'll be a much stronger leader. You don't have to like show up as a guy, like, you know, like no. Where you see a lot of, and we now do the firm handshakes and, you know, that's how, you know,
yeah.
You don't have to. I think there's stuff we can learn from men. And I mean, you know, things like negotiation in terms of my salary, I've learned from men. And, you know, there's stuff that we can learn, but also I think there's stuff that we should lean into as that are innate to us and ensure that we actually bring them to the table, because ultimately they are our superpowers. Like, don't be afraid of them, and you'll be surprised how impactful you'll be.
Absolutely. So what does legacy mean for you?
Oh, it's the good. So, I mean, maybe let me talk, because it's in like different ways, but I have thought about it. And I think the first thing is, I definitely want to have a marketing legacy. I always say I never want to be the marketer that just quietly goes out into the night. Like, you know, I never had any sort of, you know, impact in the industry. For me, as I, you know, when I finish, I definitely want to be considered one of the greats. And by the way, as I talk about that, I find it fascinating where we are in the world right now, where if someone says, like you, I want to climb the 7 summits, apparently having a big vision like that is no longer great. Like, people are like, you are a papi. Like,
exactly. Who do you think you are?
It's like the weirdest thing for me. Like, when I say I want to build the best marketing team on the continent, who do you think you are? No, I'm Sarah Kumalo is who I am. And that's what I'm going to do. And there's no way the guys would have, like, Summit gone to the moon if they hadn't had a vision or a big dream, right? And stuff. So for me, I definitely want to be known as one of the greats in marketing. And if that makes some people uncomfortable, I'm okay with that. Like, I'm not uncomfortable. Like, I love it for myself because it pushes me. And one of the greats is actually, it's different ways. One is absolutely ensuring that when I leave Nedbank or any other organization, that I've built the best marketing team on this continent. And I'm incredibly clear about that. Mm-hmm. And when I look last year for the Lurie's, we were the second most awarded brand in Africa, Middle East, and the first most awarded brand in Africa.
Amazing.
We won the Marketing Team of the Year at the Marketing Achievement Awards this year. So it's going there. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and block by block, this is what I tell my team, that if we win Marketing Team of the Year, actually, it's not me, it's you guys, because you're the team, right? It's you guys' award. It's actually not mine. So we all win because we are all driving for that. I think the second thing is transformation of the industry. I've been really clear that if, and it comes, I guess, from the purpose of the bank as well, is to ensure that if we're an organization that makes its money on this continent or makes its money in South Africa, then the agencies that we work with should reflect the country that we live in. And I think a lot of what we've done, and I'm glad the agencies that we work with as Nedbank are on the same path as me. So we've seen Joe Public, our big agency, go through an ownership sort of diversification, bringing in Black owners who come from their own staff that are quite senior in the organization, have been there for many years. And, you know, I pushed for that, ensuring that from a production perspective, because if you think of the value chain of advertising, the production houses are generally still very white owned, and trying to ensure that we give business to production houses that are also Black owned. And what you'll find interesting, Sarah, is you've got a lot of white production owned Black white owned production companies that are supportive of this. They want to be part of the journey because they realize that the more diverse visions and voices that we have, the better the work in South Africa will be. They just need someone to actually just start the conversation and push it. So we've agreed that we're going to move a lot of our marketing spend, about 30%, into Black-owned production companies. And some of them actually being helped by the white-owned production companies because they really believe in the journey. And then our outdoor, from an out-of-home, if you look at billboards, 70% of our billboards are in Black-owned hands and stuff. So for me, that legacy is about ensuring that I use my role at Nedbank to actually drive real transformation and not transformation. And I look after transformation at the bank, right? So it's not the triple B scorecard, which is important. I manage that. But it's real transformation where we're actually seeing the industry shift and we're seeing the industry change to reflect who we are as a country. And most South Africans, very supportive of that when they understand the vision that you're trying to do. So I think, and then the last thing, I guess, from marketing in terms of legacy is I would love in like a few years to be looking at the chief marketing officers across many organizations and be like, oh, they worked for me. Like,
yeah, I know you.
Yeah, yeah. I know you. And I mean, I'm so fortunate that I can tell you now, and we were having a talent discussion at work yesterday, and I was saying to the CEO, if I had to leave Nedbank now, there are 5 people who currently report to me who can get my job. They don't have to go external. They don't have. So we've built such a strong pipeline of strong, incredible marketers. Mm-hmm. And so that was always important for me that I'm like, it's easy to want to be the queen in the, you know, but actually like, no, like you don't have to be, there's many other people. So I think that's marketing. I think from a family perspective, because my hubby and I decided not to have kids, I play a big role in my nephews and nieces' life. And it's important to me, Sarah, that especially, so my sister's kids, obviously my sister's kids, so the 3 will always, I guess, get auntie love much more and stuff than my cousin's kids. But I never want a situation where there's only one Kenzie in the family. Like, I need many Alexes. So my nephews, and Alex and Amani, and Zoe's my niece. I need like all of those, like many Zoe's, many, they must be challenging each other. They must, like we, our next generation guys, they cannot be looking at, oh, will Kenzie help out here or whatever. They must all be like, if one can't, this one can or whatever. And also maybe no one needs help anymore, right? I don't know. Yeah. But for me, it's important that from a family perspective, and my parents did a really good job. We all went to varsity and, you know, and education, I think, is really important. So what you find is that I pay for school fees for a lot of people, but I don't even look at it in a negative way at all. For me, it's about ensuring that my family's legacy of excellence continues, because I do think my mom and dad were excellent. And how do we just continue to do that and ensure that we've got a family that's not in the doldrums, or like, you know, so I think that's like really important for me. And then I guess in South Africa itself, and that's about living out my purpose around like really showing the art of the possible. So as exhausted as I can get, and when I walked in, I said to Sarah, oh, I can't wait for December and to take my month off and stuff. As exhausted as I can get, I would read something like Sarah asks me to come on this podcast, Shift Happens, and I read what it means and I go, I've got to go, because that's actually so linked to my purpose. And I know that when I'm doing it, I'll be so energized. And so as tired as I can be in the morning or when I go to bed and stuff, I know that when I'm living my purpose, when I'm in it, I'm incredibly energized. And I hope that there are many young women who get inspired and energized by that and know that their starting point is absolutely not their end point. There's no way. Like where I started,
Not where I belong.
That's not where I belong, right? Yeah. But I'm here. And so every young girl, if you should always know that where you start, I mean, like I talk young girl, but you look at Sia Kolisi. I mean, I watched The Box this weekend. Yeah. Sweet day.
Yeah.
To what? Amazing. I mean, it's just, and he then gets to, his story becomes bigger than him, actually. Oh, he can't own his story. Like, it's owned by so many people who look at it and go, I can be more than where I come from.
Amazing. It's humbling, and also it creates a sense of responsibility. And one thing that I picked up from you, which I kind of struggled with after I summited Everest and I came back and there was this welcome at the airport. I was like, oh my God. Okay. I grew up saying, you know, don't show off, you know. I took a few months before I could say, hi, my name is Sarah. I am the first Black African woman to summit Everest, because I had to convince myself to own my story, to be proud of it, so that I can release other people
Absolutely.
To be also proud of what they are. So ambition, like you mentioned, it's we don't have to be apologizing.
No.
I think boys are more comfortable with it than girls are. And we need to teach our young girls to not apologize for who they want to be.
Absolutely.
To not be afraid to say, hey, I want to go beyond Everest. Because that's why you and I have done what we've done, because we know that they can go further, they can do more.
They can do more. And I think our responsibilities as adults, parents, aunts, uncles, is to allow them to dream. When I told my parents at the age of 4 that I wanted to be an astronaut, they were like, okay. She lives in Swaziland, but apparently she thinks she's going to go to NASA. Okay. But I didn't say no, hey.
Yeah.
My parents never, they just said, sounds amazing.
Go for it.
Go for it.
You know, Kenzie, all good things come to an end. So Let's have our signature question,
okay.
Which, you know, we all know that shift happens and responsibilities change. We lose our loved ones, we gain some, and we lose some as we go on. So that's what life is about, shift happening all the time. So apart from some of the shifts that you've shared, what's happened in your life that's taught you who you are and who you are becoming?
I think I spoke a little bit about where I come from, but maybe what a lot of the listeners won't know is, so I grew up in a number of countries. I grew up, you know, I lived in Moz, Zambia, Ghana, a number of countries. And what it allowed me to do is it made me incredibly open to different cultures, different people. For me, how I interact with you, I experience you is you. I've got no preconception about, you know, how you, honestly, I really have none, zero. And I think it's about taking that to the next level. I do feel like I've done a lot in South Africa, and I do think that, you know, so I've got a tattoo of Africa on my back. And so I, whilst I'm South African, I wasn't born here, lived in all these African countries. And I think I've got a responsibility for my continent, as big as I have for South Africa. Because while South Africa is like my dad's country, so I'm South African. And when we came back in 1994, you know, I love this country, but I also love my continent. And so I think my next shift is reflective of, I think, my impact on the continent. I've just been nominated for, you know, Impactful Woman in Africa, Woman in Marketing for Africa.
Amazing. Congratulations.
And thank you. And I think it's that now. It's about going beyond the borders of South Africa and thinking about how can I make a broader impact. Because also if you look at just, even though it's next door, you look at Swaziland and my family is there, they live in poverty, Sarah. And how do I ensure that whilst we're dealing with South Africa, I've got also like also help the legacy there and stuff.
Yeah.
But also just marketers on the continent. I met a lady from Nigeria. She's a marketer. So she said to me, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm meeting you. Like, I've heard so much about you in Nigeria." I was like, "Me?" So I actually realized the responsibility that I have, even for the marketing fraternity on the continent, to ensure that we are, yeah, like we make a bigger impact, like for ourselves in the world. I got WhatsApped. So for COP in Brazil, there's a guy who did a presentation and then he put my face up. So this chick is sitting in the room going, "That's Kenzie." And then he goes, "I met this lady from South Africa. I think she's one of the most authentic, inspirational leaders." She's like, "They're talking about you in Rio, girl."
Amazing.
And so you realize that actually you can have, but I've never been intentional about it. So South Africa has been very intentional, but I've never been intentional about actually how I could impact the continent and impact other women that or together even do that to ensure that I think Africa stands up. And we show, like, if you, I mean, a lot of people don't know this because maybe they're not in my industry. For Cannes Lions, which is the biggest advertising festival in the world, Africa, normally we're lucky to come out with like 5 medals and they award thousands of medals.
Oh, wow.
For a continent that is as creative as it is in so many ways, solves so many solutions in so many creative ways, for us to not be showing up. I mean, for me, actually, from a marketing and creativity perspective, what our South African sports teams are doing, doing really well, that's what we should be emulating to showcase to the world that this continent actually has some of the best marketers and creative leaders who've created the best solutions that have made real business and brand impact and actually can compete with the South Americans, the Europeans, the Americans, then the Asians. And so for me, I think that's the shift that I'm trying to figure out right now. And the thing I started about in terms of where I grew up and all of that is actually, I feel like it doesn't even scare me because I mean, it does, but also I know how easily I am able to connect with people because I'm so open. I take you as you are. And if I feel like this journey, I think, can be great if we do it together. You know, I think there's a lot of people who I can connect with on the continent who we could do this together.
Absolutely. Nobody gets to the top alone.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
But you have to be intentional about the people that you put on the rope with. They have to be the right people. Absolutely love that. I think you're right that Africa is creative. So why are we not showing up?
Yeah.
I think the world needs to see us. Sometimes we're afraid of our own shadow.
Absolutely.
Because of the history and because of where we come from. But if we have a Kenzie and another, there's a few others that are seen that are really pushing brand Africa.
Yeah.
And also the fragmentation on the continent becomes problematic. Is to try and find that thread that unites us, connects us, so that we have a united front in some of these spaces that you mentioned. So, Kenzie, you remind us very much that leadership isn't really necessarily just a position. It's a posture.
Right.
Well, I love that.
It's not about controlling the climb, but really learning to listen to the mountain. So I'm taking it back to the mountain. So it's not about, let me control everything, but listen to what's happening and adjust according to where you need to go. Because growth isn't found in certainty. It's found in grace, in choosing to rise, reflect, and redefine yourself every time shift happens. Because I don't think you shifted the same after your brother as you did after your dad and your sister. So it's shifting based on where you're at, what you need to become who you deserve to be.
Love that.
Thank you, Kenzie, for joining us. And I'm hoping that today has been as rewarding to you as it has been to me and some of the listeners that will pick this up along the way.
It absolutely has. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you to the listener. I hope you can feel the air thinning up here. Remember this, your greatest view isn't behind you. It lies just beyond the hardest climb. The shift has happened. The question is no longer why it happened, but who you become because of it. Don't wait for permission to begin your ascent. Don't let fear silence your potential. Seize the lesson. On the step, command the future. You've been listening to When Shift Happens with me, Sarah Kumalo. Now the climb begins with you. Until next time, keep stepping and let's go higher.
If you would like to explore some of the lessons and tools we spoke about today, you'll find them in the show notes. If today's conversation spoke to you, share it with someone that's facing their own climb. Together, we are rising, one shift at a time. When Shift Happens is a Jackpod original podcast by Jacaranda FM. Let's go higher.